in the sky with the Ark of the Covenant or something, and they plonked down on top of a mountain, and I was allowed to approach and look at the object. They sort of spoke and said, look at the book that's written in the blood that never dries.
Yes, hello. I'm Jason Louvre. This is the Ultra Culture Podcast. And you were just listening to Barry William Hale, today's guest, who is an occult artist and musician. Actually, the backing music is by his musical project, Noko 210, with Scott Barnes. And Barry is a fascinating guy. He is a true outlaw artist, and he's been engaged in combining practical occultism and artwork and music for the last few decades. He's explored all kinds of crazy magic territory, particularly Enochian magic, which is, of course, an interest of mine, which we focus on in this podcast, as well as Chinese magic, Taoism, Thelema, and lots more. Barry has worked with so many disciplines and is interested in so many things that it is a bit hard to encapsulate him, so let me just read you part of his biography from Folger. Barry William Hale has been described as an occult artist. While a superficially germane term, on closer inspection, it radiates a self-consciously unwelcome specificity, too redolent of those early 20th century outsider artists whose work depended on visionary states, specific knowledge of ancient mysteries, or some other Kabbalistic obscurity. Hale, it should be noted, has certainly done nothing to dissuade such labels, mischievously luxuriating in such terms when fitting. It is apparent from his biography that he is, for example, an outspoken member of the OTO. But such groups encourage individual exploration, undoubtedly an attraction to Hale, whose very genealogy radiates the outlaw. Hale was born to hardcore hippie parents who lived on one of the first Australian communes. According to the artist, his biological father was allegedly involved in distributing LSD to a grateful Australian hippie community. Hale was raised by an adoptive family of socialists and Masons, but maintains contact with his expanded family. In his studies, both esoteric and aesthetic, he has explored yogic states and even undergone periods of sensory deprivation in specifically designed laboratories. These and other intense methods of self-investigation have led to Hale working with neuroscientists to investigate biofeedback while in deep meditative states. In addition, he's a student of the Chinese martial art, Choi Li Fut, rumored to be the preferred fighting style of the triads. Hale's work across various manifestations and themes is about demons and apocalypse, the avatars of liberty, and the moments of true liberation, freeing and illuminating the human spirit. So, with a CV like that, as you might imagine, we have quite a conversation ahead of us. Barry is a true sorcerer, and you're going to find a lot of value and interesting tidbits in this podcast. Now, as you may or may not know, the practice of magic, as Barry will demonstrate in this podcast, has been kind of the open secret in the art world and with creative people for a long, long time. I'm talking about not just artists, but also musicians and writers, and anybody who's working in any type of creative medium or who is working on anything that requires them to draw inspiration from the unconscious. So that could be not just an artist, but maybe somebody looking for a business idea, maybe somebody looking for an intuitive way to solve any type of challenge in their life. And that's why I created the Magic and Art course at magic.me, my school for magic. So if you dig this show and you're fascinated by Barry Hale's application of the occult to the artistic process, then you will be fascinated by that class. It's got all of the techniques you need to get started applying occult processes to your art or your writing or whatever medium you happen to work in or whatever type of lateral thinking you need to engage in, and just to unlock incredible creative inspiration. I've got a full range of methods there for accessing the unconscious font of inspiration, and those include astral travel, unlocking lucid dreaming, writing synchronicity, sending desires directly into the unconscious, the lost Renaissance art of memory palaces, the Brian Geisen, William S. Burroughs cut-up method, Salvador Dali's paranoia critical method, and lots more. We're talking about the full toolkit that magicians and surrealists have used to supercharge the creative process. You'll walk away with a full toolkit for gaining inspiration for your art, or maybe just approaching business as an artistic process, and infusing these things with otherworldly qualities inaccessible to most. We're talking about the tools to become a truly magical artist. Check that out now at magic.me, magick.me, and dive in. That class has everything for you. And of course, it's not just that class, but it's all kinds of material. If you become a site subscriber to magic.me, you get access not only to the magic and art class, but you also get access to all kinds of classes covering the entire spectrum of magical and occult practices. So that includes chaos magic, meditation, Raja yoga, Enochian magic, mastering the tarot, unlocking your true will, achieving peak mental and physical energy, banishing rituals, astral projection, the I Ching, and lots more, and there's lots more to come. So the website is magic.me, magick.me, and with a subscription, you get access to all of the courses that are there. And what that means is you get the benefits of 20 years of occult training condensed into very simple, straightforward, step-by-step training modules that you can take on your own time. They're separated out into 5-minute segments, so even if you have a busy day job, if you need to take a little 5-minute break here and there, you can be training in all the skills you need to unlock your true will and actualize yourself as a truly magical being in this space and time. I know you're going to love it, and I can't wait to see you in class. Okay, so with no further ado, please give a warm welcome to Barry William Hale. Let's just get into it. I'm excited to talk to you.
And, oh, great. Cool.
I've been aware of your art for a while, probably like 10 years or something like that. And you've always struck me as a guy who's been to some intense and extreme places in a sincere way. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, cool. Well, that's good. I think it's often difficult for people because of the way that I work to kind of, and it doesn't come across as, I suppose typical occultists would consider the way of doing things or the visual form and stuff like that. So sometimes it's hard for a lot of them. I think you've got like a kind of a more broader, from what I know about you, you've got a much broader, aesthetic and experience with, that I think would possibly be able to kind of like, understand where I'm coming from a bit better.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you're doing original work, you know, which is tricky in any medium, but you know, the occult has such a, it's often so backwards looking in a way and concerned with replicating things that have gone on in the past, you know, like museum pieces, and you're doing new stuff and unique work. And what I've taken from what I've seen of your work is it's just pretty clear to me that you're going into some out there places and reporting back, if that's a fair.
I think that's a fair assessment. I don't think it's in any way, unorthodox to occult process, you know. I mean, it's pretty stock standard. It's just it's just the forms that it sort of comes out and takes, sort of maybe not what people expect. And I think it's true just with occult publishing and I think the occult scene in general is backward looking, and it sort of seems really anachronistic or something, and it doesn't seem to be forging a lot of new ground.
Why do you think that is, and what type of new ground do you think should be forged?
Well, I mean, you know, just if we kind of look at like the, say, Enochian magic, for example, I think that there was a couple of different camps, and I think, early on, the GD and stuff were kind of like exploring that pretty rigorously, and then and then as more of these source material became more widely available, and people wanted to go back to the source and look at reconstruct a more kind of authentic working methodology. And I think that I kind of noticed that, and I think it's really interesting. And I think with the flood of books and think, when I started with the, interested in Crowley and the occult and stuff, I mean, we were exchanging photocopies and sending them overseas and stuff. So, I mean, I think it's a really vibrant sort of time, but I just sort of find that there seems to be this want of a sort of an authenticity, which they equate with an older kind of methodology. And I think that a lot of the time there's a lot of focus on the technical of like how it should be done. But I think that the most important thing for me is having a connection with agency and new material or inspiration coming forth. And I don't think that agency really, really cares about, it has to be look a certain way. So I think, I hear a lot of, a lot of stuff that's really great survey and a great, expounding, upon source material. I think that's really important. But I think it's also important to sort of take those methodologies and to try and, talk to the angels, really.
Absolutely.
This is where they take you. You know what I mean? And and I think that it's important to historical information, and the more the better. I mean, I'm a total sucker for all of that sort of stuff. But a lot of times I see a lack of inspiration, or which really kind of comes through. It's sort of like, when the Wizard of Oz goes to Technicolor or something, it's like, oh, right, we're here. This is what it's about. But that's just my personal experience, though, because I love it all, and I really like the work that, people are doing, the same, people sort of working with, with the explosion of grimoire traditions. And then, sort of different influences like you can sort of see over the years with looking at different modes like, the Afro-Caribbean and diasporic traditions, different relationships of working with spirits, I suppose, I think it's exciting.
It is exciting. I mean, my take on it is magic is and always has been a living and breathing art. And in a lot of ways, that's why I think that it fits so well with the artistic process, and artistic people just get it right away. But a lot of times people obsess over the details, which is also important. It's important for getting the historical context right and getting a sense of what these things really are. But a lot of times I found that when people obsess over the minutiae, sometimes that can be a way of trying to control the experience and kind of putting a prophylactic over it in a way, like trying to keep it at arm's distance instead of plunging right into it. Because, the dirty secret is that magic is not difficult at all, right? It just takes the willpower to do it. And then, as you say, it's kind of like the lights coming on in Technicolor, and then you go from there. But for most people, that's frightening, mostly because it can't be structured or contained in, and that's one of the places that I think we get these really elaborate magical systems coming out of, is people trying to control and constrain the experience. But I'm with you. I like both camps. And obviously I've done a lot of work in getting the historical accuracy of Enochium in particular, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, there's a propensity for, for there to emerge like power brokers, and that I've never really been, I don't think that, I think that the magical process is a uniquely individual one, and it's an intensely personal experience with you and the divine, or however you want to, describe it. And I think that sometimes, sometimes these structures and, different, commentators on the minutiae and stuff, they're kind of too busy kind of naysaying, saying you can't do that. Yeah.
That's what you mean by power brokers, like people who decide that they're the expert over that small fiefdom of magic.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of people that I think that I've always been of the camp. If I don't know something, I'd like to talk about it and hear what other people have got to say about it from their own experience, because I think that's a much better way, exploring and learning together. And that I think that also sometimes I think that for example, I think there's with the grimoire traditions, there's been a lot of gaps, in the technology. And so it has been sort of, and that's because there was some, oral traditions and certain sort of techniques and practices and stuff like that, that were expected of you, but they didn't sort of really translate in the, and I think a lot of the grimoires are, some of them at least are like liber personal, liber spiritums. And then, so it's kind of like, you've got the register, make the contact, they give you the initial structures, and then, let the spirits dictate, how best to interact with them and stuff like that. So I think it's really good that there is so much research with that, because it pads out some of the gaps,
Yeah, I agree. I've come to a couple conclusions about the grimoire. I mean, I know there's been so much emphasis on grimoire authenticity of late, and I've kind of come to two conclusions about it. One is, if you imagine back to, whoever was writing these things, 800 years ago, it was probably somebody just like us with way less information than us. It was probably, like some weird kid in like a moldy room somewhere in the Midlands in England, getting high off of moldy bread and writing down what he was coming up with, So the idea that there's some like deep authenticity there, let me put it this way, that there's authenticity just because the source is old, as opposed to whatever unique research is going on today. Maybe. But the other thing that really emerged out of my work with Enochian is that I find fascinating is going through those spirit diaries. There's a part where the angels directly tell Dean Kelly that the grimoire tradition is kind of mankind's best fumbling attempt to make a crude carbon copy of Enochian, and that Enochian is the true magic, and it's basically beyond the ability of mortals to comprehend. And that I found fascinating.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's high tech, right? And I mean, I think there's another thing that I kind of noticed, you can obviously see, influence of different writers and grimoires within Dee's material, and also structural kind of semblance, from the Sigil de Ameth and lots of different sort of stuff. I think it's, what's really interesting is that I kind of thought, it's kind of when you read something, you go, I've kind of sort of read that before or something. And you're going, I don't think it's magical plagiarism, but it's like some of these formulas and things work really well, and they stand the test of time. So they are incorporated into later recensions and I think that that some of those semblances as well, you can see really condensate really crystal in with D, and D's system that he received. So it's just there's nothing quite, I think, compares to, the depth and the elaborate nature of the technology. So,
yeah, and I think there's multiple parts in the records, too, where Dee is bringing the angels, the Gamoras, and, for instance, Liber Gerardus, and with the original Sigillum de Ameth, and they're saying that, the angels are saying, like, yeah, this is correct, but it's just like a really bad rendition of it. Let's give you the real thing. So there seemed to be, it was almost like the grimoire tradition was kind of making fumbling attempts to uncover this topography that was there somewhere in the architecture of reality. And then the Enochian sessions, or the angels just saying, well, here you go. Here's the full thing.
I mean, I think that's the essential problematic with, contacting pratahuman or, you know, intelligence of a different dimension, like how it kind of like ends up and is represented here as kind of a different dimensional glyph of a type of an extraordinary experience.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you an easy question.
Yeah.
What are pratahuman intelligences?
Well, I suppose anything that is non-corporeal, I suppose. And I would kind of balk at the pratahuman intelligence, but by definition it fits the bill, just because of Crowley's speaking about that, you know. And I wouldn't claim to have that type of caliber of interaction, I suppose. But if I was to talk about the angels of the aethers or any type of supernatural agency, in different magical systems, I suppose you could call them pratahuman.
Well, you must have had some, just from looking at your artwork, so much of your artwork is based around exploring different ranks and files of spirits and things like that.
Yeah.
So you must have had some pretty intense experiences in that arena. Maybe some of the experiences you can share with us in that regard, and maybe conclusions you've drawn from them about, or maybe not even just the conclusions. I mean, what have your experiences contacting beings been like?
Well, I mean, it'd be like two kind of examples, I suppose, would be the work that I did with Beelzebub that was kind of like a research project, because I kind of, saw that he was kind of fairly underrepresented, but fairly prominent as well. So I kind of set about looking at the different historical eruptions where, where Beelzebub is kind of like, coming on the scene, whether it's like, the Testament of Solomon or the Axion Possessions or the Cotton Mather's manuscript, or Jainus Wearer's The Infernal Parliament, just to sort of look for sort of source material to sort of see where there's sort of kind of an eruption of that sort of thing. And then, of course, I suppose my primary reference for working with that was the Grimoire Verum. And, the nature of how I work I work with in a collaboration, Noko Tutan, and we basically, propose an operation, discuss the parameters, decide on a ritual structure, explore different kind of data or information that can be kind of sonified or incorporated into a sound production that feeds back into a ritual process. And really the way that I look at most of the operations is that I'm not really aware of what the outcomes are going to be. I just have the idea to work with, and then set about the kind of preliminary kind of ritual structure, and then as we go along, and usually that sort of that is complemented by an intense focus on research and investigative stuff. So as I'm doing it, I'm sort of exploring, researching, and then as we go, usually, we'll get information that talks about that informs the how to refine the ritual process, to, you know, have a better wiring for the connection. And
is that, just to jump in real quick, is that information you're getting from magical ritual itself through inspirational states, yes, things like that?
Yes. Well, I mean, it can happen in a number of different ways, because the whole period of the working, in a sense, becomes like a magical envelope, really. And so it's like during that time, you know, I'll get stuff in ritual, and then, you know, I'll get stuff in dream. Sometimes it will stuff that's related specifically to what I'm working with will come in really unexpected sort of ways, you know. So I think it's sort of that idea that, you know, that the agency sort of finds the best ways of, like, communicating with you through a variety of different dreams. It may be, like, you know, like a you know, like a dream, like a direct kind of, like, download, a kind of an internal conversation, or, you know, like a recording of, like, a dialogue that happens within the working. It might be a piece of information or some kind of chance thing happens that relates specifically to the working itself. So in a sort of sense, it's sort of like the whole period of the time that I'm working with something, life becomes that sort of magical envelope. It's kind of, I suppose it's kind of like a controlled pro-psychotic sort of mode, you know what I mean? Like, with, it's kind of related to a teleology, but it's not like an end result sort of thing. It's like an ongoing kind of emerging sort of meaning making kind of experience that saturates most aspects of the time in life at that period. Of course, I mean, there's times when you got to make dinner and stuff like that.
Right,
but also, like, you know, I think that there's other times when, you know, there's just the intercession of stuff, and it's like, well, you need to, you know, and you get it at, like, a time you're not expecting. I don't know if that makes kind of any sense.
It does. So if I'm, well, let me just make sure I've got it right. So my understanding of what you're explaining of your working process is that you're kind of, it sounds to me like you kind of have a free form ritual framework and also an artistic framework. And this may go on over some period of time, and you're kind of monitoring dreams, synchronicities, and, you know, maybe portentous events that occur during that framework. Is that right? During that time?
Yeah. Yeah, except I would sort of qualify it as that my ritual process, and, well, the research is pretty rigorous.
Okay.
My ritual process is quite structured. And
what structure do you follow? Just a traditional Crowley type, or?
Sorry?
Do you follow, like, you know, traditional Libero or Golden Dawn, or what type of structure do you use?
Well, I mean, I think, initially, my early exposure to ritual practice was GD, but filtered through, you know, like Thelemic, post Golden Dawn. But, you know, like, Crowley's got a lot of he kind of sort of departs somewhat from the GD, but there's a strong GD sort of base there. It might be like, you know, when I first started working with Enochian, Lieber Hanok was my source reference. But then as I went on and, explored, and, you know, just became more accessible, these material, and even things like color correspondences and stuff like that, I started to change things because, you know, and that also, for me, the Enochian pronunciation guide of the Golden Dawn by putting vowels after consonants, although I started like that, you know, fairly quickly, because there was, people sort of pioneering that research, you know, like the, in the early days, so I had sort of access to that sort of stuff. So I was looking at, you know, different versions of that stuff. But of course, doing a survey from, you know, like Rudd's material, The small amount of Rudd's material on Anokin, the Aurum Solis, the Golden Dawn, and also I think the other guy who was doing some interesting work, Anokin Temples. It was an American guy.
Benjamin Rowe.
Oh, Benjamin Rowe. Yeah. Then of course, you know, I think some of the early Chaos Brococo, was it? There was a couple of people that were writing about their sort of experiences with Anokian magic, and so I was a bit of a sponge, you know. Naturally, I was tending to kind of strip away and find some incongruencies with the. The GD stuff, but then, you know, I went to the Sloan and spent some time with Dee's original material, and I was pretty excited as well because I was fortunate to know people in the early 90s who were really doing some really great research and they were wanting to sort of pass around Dee's source material and talk about it and. So I just sort of, GD stuff and that sort of stripped away. But I think this was before the Dee Purist sort of thing, had come about. But I think that came later with, and having the old magical child Cosabon diaries and stuff like that. So I just sort of started to strip away and what ended up, initially in the very early 90s, the local OTO in Sydney Oceania Lodge, we decided to do the Aethers over 30 weeks. And that was my first introduction to that. And then I wanted to explore, aspects of the Anokian watchtowers and stuff, and then that was around the time as well that I kind of met Scott Barnes from the Art Magical Collaboration Noko 210, and we decided to explore, bring our respective magical and artistic sensibilities to exploring the 16 sub quadrants of the four watchtowers and the Table of Union, which took us a few years.
Right.
And so that sort of, I suppose it just became refined. Then I think from there, I just started to concentrate more upon the actual Anokian alphabet itself, or the angelic alphabet, referred to modern occultists as Anokian.
right. Well, let's talk about this. So this is your current project also, right? So Noko is your musical collaboration. And I see that you've done some stuff with Anokian, and that's your focus right now. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that Noko 210 is pretty much the intersection of, like, it's like an artistic magical, it's a crossroads of my artistic and magical practice and Scott Barnes' artistic and sound production. Yeah, we met in at art college and had a interest. I'd already been working with the Anokian system for a few years, and it was sort of came up. It's like, hey, well, why don't we do something? And it was like, yeah, okay, well, let's try and do that. And so that's sort of how it. So our first working was Noko Hanok, which was, working with Lieber Hanok and working with the structure of the watchtowers. And then we produced an audio visual piece and which was documentation of the magical working process. And so the way that we sort of presented is sort of it'll be a combination of the research and, performing the rituals and, documenting, with video and sound sometimes. And that will lead me to, develop an artistic series of works that's related to the workings specifically. And so we, you know, we started working with the Enochian system, and it's our main, you know, for 25 years, it's been our main bread. Although we have like had some segues and which reflect different aspects of my magical research into Liber, Crowley's Liber 231, and also you know, when I was asked to write a book for Fulga, and you know, and Robert Ansell was particularly interested in a series of paper cuts that I'd produced based around the 49 servitors of Beelzebub from the Book of Abramelin.
Right.
And so I'd sort of done that, and I'd had an exhibition in London, in Islington, and around the exhibition we had a series of talks and workshops. I did a workshop there, and with and also David Rankin, uh-huh. Who was Stephen Skinner. Like, he was there talking about that. He just, him and Stephen had just published their Enochian book. And Lon Milo DeQuette was there doing a workshop on the aether vision, visionary stuff. And I did a practical workshop on the applications of the letters.
Very cool. I have to ask, 25 years is a long time to be doing Enochian magic.
Yeah.
If you can look back over all that time, what the first thing that comes to your mind, what is the craziest experience you've had with Enochian, and what happened?
Jeez. I mean, there's been such a variety of experience. I wouldn't really know where to...
Well, whatever comes to mind first. If it's not the craziest, that's okay. But
well, I think that I don't know. You know, it's like there's such a variety of different experiences. I think that at different times, I think with like a more direct visionary experience that sort of unfolded into the nature. Well, you know, you know, I was always kind of miffed that there was so much writing and exploration on the on Dee's you know, magical system, like, you know, the watchtowers and the heptarchic and other aspects, but there was fairly little information that had been really, other than that, on the actual Enochian alphabet. And I said, well, this is the kernel of it, right? I was like, this is the you know, what Dee claims of the Enochian alphabet, and sort of being, you know, the you know, to sort of you know, the you know, the primary or the originary, you know, language which Adam spoke in the garden, and or, you know, the language that Enoch spoke with to God while he walked with him, or something like that. I was like, this is the essence, and so I really wanted to create and work specifically with the alphabet, and allow the alphabet itself and the letters and, you know, and the unfold and to communicate, you know, the mysteries around the alphabet itself. So in one of my early experiments that I was working, just like, you know, which was pretty fundamental, it's like learning the alphabet itself and working with it in a mantric kind of way, forwards and backwards and stuff. Like, so fairly elementary, but in utilizing some of the keys in accordance and stuff like that. That, you know, I had a vision which was the inspiration that sort of laid the groundwork for you know, the next couple of decades of work, and was basically like a vision of two giant angels like careering in the sky with a like something. Well, it looked like the Ark of the Covenant or something, and they plonked down on top of a mountain, and then you know, and there was, and I was allowed to approach and look at the object that was sort of like a cubular, for want of a better, you know, a better description. And then, but it was like, and then, you know, they sort of spoke and said, this is, look at the book of, that's written in the blood that never dries. And as I was looking at it, it was like I was looking into I could see the entire contents and the interior, and it was kind of moving. And it was like, it was like being able to see the entire book, but it wasn't like, in a linear, it's like a non-arboreal kind of sort of model. And it was just sort of this sense that in some sense I had a vision of the, like a substrate of the substrate of the book or the ark or the contents. And then there was kind of like a line of people, or like they looked like kind of religious or prophet sort of figures that were all lined up, sort of coming to look at the, to gaze on this miraculous book, or this sort of multidimensional kind of book. And then they would sort of tear a page from the top, and then it would dry, and then a great citadel would sort of appear in the desert until, and then each, and I think it was sort of something like that each of the different prophets or the holy books or the whatever had been sort of like, had been taken from this, but then once they'd sort of taken a page from it, it had dried, and it sort of in sense become an obfuscation to the immediate experience of what revelation or prophecy was. I mean, I'm still, I've thought about it over the years, but what it did lead me to is to continue my work with the alphabet and to sort of probe those sort of mysteries, so I could kind of like better understand it. Like maybe it's like a mystical or spiritual substrate of, maybe it's a, like a multidimensional way to our articulation or representation of logos. I'm not sure. Which, I mean, usually locates itself in, time and space, so you have this kind of notion of, something that, this is sort of like an intercession or like whether it's, I suppose the way that sort of ties into the Enochian thing is that in my explorations with the alphabet, I, explored other, first started with the Abrahamic kind of traditions, and the application of the letters and their books, from the Torah or the Jewish tradition, and the application of the Islamic alphabet within their mystical system and stuff like that, and also the Greek with the New Testament, and then things went on from there, just to sort of try to kind of go out and look at the way those traditions like looked at the what they purported that their language was the language of God, right? And so how they took the letters and ran with them to sort of try and inform speculate and inform different methodologies or magical methodologies and different deep thought and applications of the Enochian the Enochian alphabet. And so, I don't know if that's...
That's a beautiful vision. And that's what was that?
Well, I'm relaying it to memory. I mean, it's very hard to sort of talk about it. I mean, it was kind of profound to me at the time. And then the other thing was... Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, it was funny because that each time that they came and tore a book off, and then that kept happening until the whole vista of the desert in front of the mountain was just blacked out. It was just gone. So it was just
Interesting. Yeah. It's interesting you use the word substrate also, because that's a word that for some reason keeps coming up for me around Enochian and in my descriptions of Enochian to people, both in terms of the substrate of consciousness, getting into the substrate of consciousness, but then also just what you said now, trying to understand the substrate beneath other religions, as if, religions are kind of fungal blooms from one single substrate underlying all of them. Enochian seems to.
Well, I think that, Cooliano sort of puts forth a really interesting idea in that relationship in the Tree of Gnosis when he talks about the morphogenic sort of field and stuff, and that, you know, more, you know, that the when you get humans and, you know, people, that certain sort of narratives and spiritual kind of stuff like emerges, and it's just what happens, and so it's not like trying to find like a tradition that you know, is passed on in a linear or historical sort of manner, because I don't think these things do. And especially if you kind of like consider for a moment that, you know, or postulate the theory that, you know, some of the greatest turning points in humanity have been responsible because of the collusion with agency, or the collusion with downloads that are not of this dimension. And I think so then it starts to kind of get pretty freaky.
Yes, indeed.
And I think that's the primary thing. I think that, you know, like looking at you know, even going back to the grimoire tradition, it's like, well, why do people want to talk to spirits? I mean, sure, they might want to get things done, but, you know, they want to know information. I mean, it goes back to the, the earliest kind of things, you know, with the early things with the Books of Enoch and the fallen, you know, angels and stuff like that, or whatever, communicating these technologies and stuff like that. Maybe that's a historical artifact of, you know, how Göbekli Tepe was built, or how the Egyptians just like were able to, you know, do what they do, or I'm not really sure. I mean, the spiritual anthropology is not my strong point, but I think that it seems to be that the primary directive, like in magic, at least what I can see is setting up communication and getting the goods and trying as best we are as mere mortals to kind of like with our monkey brains to get our head around it, right? Or to be, effective conduits for the will of great, you know, things that are far greater than ourselves, perhaps. I don't know.
Or greater or different or lesser or all kinds of things, you know.
Yeah,
that kind of brings us back to the beginning of the conversation too, where we were talking about the obsession with grimoire purism. Where, you know, just what you said now, I mean, the point is to make contact with these things, and presumably, you know, how people did it in the 14th century is not, you know, all you need is, you know, you need the magician and whatever is being contacted and some mutually agreed upon method for making contact, you know.
Sure.
So, sometimes the grimoires are very useful, and sometimes it's like, you know, trying to perfectly construct a Yellow Pages from the 14th century or something like that.
Well, I mean, they're interesting documents of a methodology, right? And so they do in some way, you can glean into the fundamental aspects of, you know, how. How the different ways that people might go about it, but I think the one thing is that the idea was that you might have had preliminary exercises to, you know, like all preparatory sort of stuff to, you know, help make you a better conduit. But, I think that that's why I think the Liber Spiritum is a really great model, because it's like, then you get like, you know, your own personalized signatures of the spirits, and you have your own packs worked out, and then you got them in your book, you know what I mean? And I think that, I think Barden's interesting in that case too, you know, like, I think Barden is often kind of overlooked. I mean, he's got some really interesting stuff there, but I think this Liber Spiritum model is great. It's like, well, and the idea that those names of the particular spirits and the sigils, that they change, and it's important that the best way is to get your own, you know, get your own for that register of spirits or whatnot.
I agree. Yeah, Barden being overlooked is an interesting one, in the sense that, well, you know, his work is hard. and also he doesn't have the subcultural cachet of Crowley or something like that. So you can see that, you know, people who are
he's very German as well, and they're very rigorous, and they like their and I think that was interesting, because I was listening to a conversation, I think it was Stephen Flowers on the Return of Saturnus, yeah. And talking about some of the source material, the German source material for some of Baden's and also the FS. And I can't remember where I heard it, but it was recently, and he was kind of sort of talking about the rigor of the Germans, and they like their I think that's why Germer served Crowley well afterwards, like, you know, no one will keep it sort of, you know, like all of the things in order and like a German father, you know.
yeah, totally. I was in Berlin late last year, and I was marveling at just the perfect efficiency of everything. And the thing that sticks out in my mind from that trip, this is completely unrelated to magic, but in terms of, you know, this attention to detail, I went into the bathroom in the train station in downtown Berlin, and first of all, you had to pay €1 to get in, and I went in, and the toilet was, when you flush the toilet, the seat rotated 360 degrees underneath a thing with a UV light to disinfect the seat, that was also spraying some type of disinfectant with essential oils on it. And it was just this perfectly, like almost too perfect H.R. Geiger vision of absolute cleanliness. I've just been telling that story to everyone. It's like I just had to get it in there. But yeah, the German efficiency, you know, that's really fascinating about the FS also, which is I'm looking forward to reading. I haven't gotten to Stephen Flowers' book about that yet, but I'm looking forward to reading about that.
Yeah, well, I just came from China, so toilets are very different there.
Oh yeah, what's it like there?
Oh, you know, it's a hole in the ground, essentially, with like lots of water kind of running everywhere.
Okay. Where was this in China?
Huh?
Where was this in China?
Oh, in South China. I was in southern China, in Tsinghuai and Gingmoy, a little village, and about an hour and a half northwest of Guangzhou.
Wow, were you over there for any specific reason?
Oh yeah, no, I was over there for a birthday celebration of the founder of the Kung Fu style that I practiced for, you know, forever, and so there was a big government and a big gathering of like all of the, you know, it's a 200-year-old tree, so. People, there was just, you know, 2,000 people there, and there was related and family all along, just coming back to the ancestral hall to pay their respects, and so it was pretty wild, you know.
Wow. So yeah, I've read that you practice this Kung Fu style that is perhaps the fighting style of the triads. I'm curious about this.
From the Hong Kong rooftop fighting days, Chorley Phut was my teacher's grandfather before the Cultural Revolution taught in many different societies, so it really sort of spanned a great all of the different striations of Chinese culture, from doctors to vegetable growers and fishmongers guilds and firemen's guilds and the steel workers guilds and stuff. So it's sort of strand, but you know, it seemed to and I think, you know, it probably goes to the early history of the destruction of the Shaolin Temple, and that our founder was kind of taught by you know, Monk Choi Fook, who was the librarian at the Southern Temple, and he was one of the few that escaped, but he was called Rottenhead because he got burnt in the fire. Probably grabbing as many manuscripts as I think he could, but he went and hid out on Lofu San, which was one of the sacred. It's a sacred Taoist peak, so he was up there, and they were hiding him. And but anyway, you know, so there's always this notion with some of the martial arts sort of styles that they want to, you know, like they've been at odds with the government, or there's that sort of revolutionary aspect. And I think that some of those sort of activities go into the Hong League and, you know, the White Lotus sect and all these sort of revolutionary societies which were trying to kind of like, train people for, you know, like the different rebellions and stuff like that. But, you know, you had the Cultural Revolution, which kind of smashed all that's much, much later. But a lot of people kind of, you know, were in the South, you know, it's quite a, you know, Guangzhou is only like just across the water from Hong Kong. And so Chorley Phut traveled a lot with the, through Southeast Asia and America. And, there's an implication that, you know, it was the preferred fighting style of the triads because it was good with multiple attacking and sort of street fighting. And so, and there's always been a healthy rivalry between Wing Chun and Chorley Phut, you know, it goes back to some funny stories there. But, so it's sort of like, it's like one of those kind of urban sort of myth things, I suppose.
You haven't met any triad people in your training, or
have I what?
Met any triad people or sparred people in your training?
I mean,
that you can talk about.
I wouldn't say whether I have or I haven't, but I've met some interesting people, and what I'd like reiterate is it really does span a lot of different stratas of society. And I think that also the other thing is that I think, you know, after the Cultural Revolution, you know, things had to be kind of, I mean, fairly much like martial training and stuff like that, and old traditional traditions and things were had to be kept, you know, undercover. And so and I think people had to survive. So they were kind of, you know, they kept connections that they had, and they took care of business. And I think that would have, I mean, I know what side I would have been on.
What side is that?
Well, the side that sort of, you know, like the side that, you know, resists oppression promotes, freedom disposes despotism and tyranny, something like that.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I'm just on a side note. I mean, I'm fascinated with China right now, and I'm curious. I've never been there, although I would like to go soon. I'm curious what it's like on the ground over there. I mean, was that your first time there, or have you been over there many times?
Well, I mean, I'm fortunate with my experience in China because, it's funny because when I travel with my teacher. You know, like my teacher, like reminds people in China of something about the cultural DNA, which has been really eroded, you know, by modern China. And it's really strange to see. China is just like incredible. It's like it's just the way it works is like it's insane, you know, and it sort of seems to function. You don't really notice. You can't step out of line, but as a Westerner and stuff, you've got a lot of latitude, and I mean, it functions pretty well. I mean, like I've been probably kind of more fortunate because my experience has been within that in relationship to Kung Fu and Qigong, and my Sifu being who he is, and so. You know, I get a really great inroad into, tradition and, you know, stuff like that. Although I did go to, I was in Beijing for an artist in residency, and that's the north, and that's a totally different experience. So I'm more familiar with the southerners, you know, I'm more familiar with the Cantonese speaking and their Cantonese culture. Beijing is just like, it's chaotic, it's crazy, it's exciting, it's really different, you know, but I've always had a sort of a fascination with you know, with Taoism and Buddhism and you know, my early days was with you know, Japanese martial arts. So like, as from a young age, I was very fascinated with Bushido and those types of things, which kind of informed me. But yeah, so I don't know if that helps, but yeah, it's an adventure. And
anything
so,
you recommend seeing for sure?
Oh wow! I mean, there's so much. There's just so much to see. I mean, you know, I particularly. I mean, there's some great countryside too. That's the thing. If you get out of the metropolitan centres, but you know, like you know, so much, so much. I mean, I loved going to Mount Lofusan, and you know, the large, you know, Taoist temple, and also I liked in Beijing seeing the one of the main Taoist sort of temples, which sort of has the depictions of all of the departments of hell. So you know, it's all these life-size statues of these different the department for you know, forestries or something, and you've got like these bugbears, and it's just fantastical. It's like off the hall. Wow. So,
well, I recently had Lam De Ket on the podcast, and he's been over there recently teaching magic. He said that people were fascinated by it over there. So I wonder if you had any, if you came across, well, I mean, you mentioned some stuff already, but interesting occult things in your travels there.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of my friends through Kung Fu, he's a Taoist sort of priest, and I've always sort of been quite interested in, well, I get a fairly authentic sort of Chan Buddhist kind of experience with the Chorley Phut, because, you know, my teacher, I mean, you know, it's, you know, five generations of, you know, download from, you know, Choi Fook, who was like, you know, like I said, was the Shaolin sort of tradition. But, you know, like those traditions, they say in China that there's three threads that are interwoven, you know, Buddhism, Taoism and Confucianism. And it's really hard to kind of like, you can't really sort of separate them. The sensibility as well is really remarkable, like their aesthetic and their kind of reverence of sort of nature and like forms and stuff is really quite unique. I think, what was your question? It was to do with the occult.
Just interesting occult things that you.
Well, I mean, I've sort of been, working with, I've had a particular interest in, the influence of Taoism on Crowley, which is really, really profound. And but I think that and his China experience, I think it's kind of often sort of overlooked. And I've been sort of fortunate enough to one of my sort of, you know, colleagues. He studies classical Chinese, so he translates classical Chinese at ANU, which is the Australian National University. He has one of the best lecturers in, you know, leading kind of exponents. And his focus and specialist is on Chinese alchemical texts. And he happens also to be very he's got a really great grounding in he speaks Greek as well, so he's like he's quite talented. But a few people that I work with, I've been exploring the, you know, more specifically the influence of Taoism, and then also you know, Crowley's links to that, and the Ling Bao Taoist school, of which, you know, he says that, you know, he was connected there, you know, in one of his previous incarnations. Uh-huh. So there's been a couple of, I'm just sort of preparing in the next month to as part of a retreat. It's a 3-day retreat that the focus is on Taoism and Thelema, and there was three of the guys who I worked with on that project lectured in Hong Kong last year.
Wow, that's fascinating. I would love to hear more about that.
I'll keep you abreast, because it's sort of kind of exciting. So like the other thing is the, you know, like a lot of people, it's just really interesting that like Liber Trigrammaton is like, you know, part of Crowley's holy books, but you know, Rigardi didn't get it. You know, he didn't get it. He even says I doesn't know the value of it or whatnot.
That's one of the best ones.
Well, that's what Rigardi said. I mean, Rigardi like didn't have that in the Gems from the Equinox, and it's because he didn't get it. And I think a lot of the legacy that we have,
he didn't have it, or he didn't understand.
No, he had it. Of course, he had it.
He didn't understand it. Okay.
No. Yeah. He didn't get it. He even, you know, there's some correspondence that talks about him sort of talking about. I don't really know if that's really, you know, that important or something like that. It's like, well, it's a Class A text, so it probably is pretty important. And then if you put in like Crowley's, you know, upstate New York kind of experience, and then it's all sort of. With our Alamantra and stuff, it's like it's all happening, you know, and it's right. Pretty, it sort of happens at a fairly significant sort of stage of what Crowley's, you know, his, you know, I suppose his, you know, roadmap of spiritual illumination.
Yeah. It certainly seems to be where he kind of ended up also towards the end. He was so fascinated with it. And I'm sure you must be familiar with C.F. Russell's stuff also.
Oh, yeah. I love it. I mean, like, yeah, he's out, you know, but I really like C.F. Russell's stuff because, I mean, I love his artwork and I love it's just like, and then it, this sort of pure mathematics, it's just like, what the fuck is that? But it's fantastic, yeah, right? Yeah. It's like, it's fantastical. And, well, you know, he was connected with the, he had a link with the Corazon Club too, right?
I think he started it, didn't he?
Yeah.
San Diego. It all sounded fairly sordid to me, but yeah.
Oh, well, you know, hey, you know, like, you know, it's like, well, you know, it, you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, like, well, well, how sordid is it really? Do you know what I mean? It's just, you know.
Well, like, it sounded like largely a cover for, surreptitious gay orgies in the 50s.
Yeah, but hey, man, you know, like...
They were having fun.
Yeah, well, that's it, right? You know, like, different strokes, different folks, right? Just like, and doing magic at the same time. It's right. Like, rock on, brothers, whatever, you know, like... But, I think there's such a, you know, interesting history about, you know, like of American occultism and specifically, like, you know, the Thelemic connections there. But that's a whole nother topic, right?
Definitely. Well, one thing that I definitely want to ask you about is your work with sensory deprivation and also biofeedback and neuroscience. I definitely want to make sure, because we could spiral off into the Thelemic Minutia conversation.
For hours, I'm sure.
But I want to make sure that I get this into the interview, because I think it's fascinating, and I think my listeners will find it fascinating also.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I mean, I was asked by some guys in America who I'd kind of obliquely sort of met through, I used to be responsible for the implementation of the Chan family Chorley Phut system in North America. And so I was, between, you know, Hawaii and Canada and, you know, San Diego and Georgia. And so I was teaching in America about twice a year for like 9 years or something like that, until everyone had kind of got up to speed. And during that time, I'd sort of I'd met some guys that were, you know, pretty interested in kind of like primarily pretty alternative kind of approaches to sort of a business and investment sort of stuff, which is really not my sort of you know, that's not my angle or anything, but they contacted me and asked me if I'd be interested in checking out like a course, and I'm like, well, you know, what's it about? And they said, so it was at the BioCybernaut Institute, I think it was in San Bernardino, and the guy who was running it, the doctor there, was Dr. Jim Hart, and he had a long history of working. I mean, that's some really interesting stuff. Like he was, I think he was a product of the 70s and stuff like that. And he was a scientist, and his specialty was, brain cartography. And so the biofeedback, basically how it was set up is there was sort of like a hyperbolic chamber. So he had this series of like a sealed, hermetically sort of sealed chamber that was dark, and that you would have a net with a sort of a sensors sort of like put at sort of stuck to, you know, your head, and it would measure different types of brain activity in the different part lobes of the brain and stuff like that. It's quite, you know, and then the course was like 10 days, and I spent 10 days working for many hours in this chamber, and that you would basically have be trying to increase the course was the aim of that particular one was to increase alpha brain waves, right? And so he was really not of the camp of the artificially induced alpha states, which I think there's some other technology which I think can help induce an alpha wave brain state. So this was sort of like pretty much developing the the brain's capacity to increase alpha brain waves, and that was documented. That it was kind of recorded over the different would occur in different time epochs, and then it would sort of flash up. The only thing would flash up when you had an increase, the highest alpha activity in what particular part of the brain. The occipital, the temporal, or whatever it was, and when you were decreasing, and then after that there'd be kind of like a fairly intensive debrief in a kind of a different part, which was kind of a very sedate kind of therapeutic kind, very very cushy sort of thing. So it'd be kind of like a record made of your experience, because some strange stuff happens when you spend 10 days in a dark place the way that the activity was fed back to you was in sound, like surround sound sort of thing. So you would get a spatial kind of representation of different like sound, which would kind of like warble, and you had a threshold. When the threshold was met, it would sort of go into another sort of octave or something. But basically it was like a exteriorization of the actual activity that was happening in the brain, represented sort of in a sound sort of way in a dark place. Does that make any sense? You might know more about feedback than me.
So why increased alpha waves? What's the perceived benefit of that?
Okay, I think that the way that Jim had done a lot of work with he'd had positive responses with people with chronic addiction and things like that. I think the way that he described alpha brainwaves to me was like it's kind of like it's like the zest of life. It's like a real it's been a while, you know, Jason, but it's like, you know, wait, you know, it's like well, it's different from theta, because theta we kind of understand as sort of being kind of, you know, say like a typical kind of like in between dream state, or sort of characteristic perhaps of, you know, like Tibetan Buddhist meditation or something like, and delta brainwaves being something else again. Gamma was just fuzz, and alpha was like life force, I think, or it was kind of like a very a positive, like, seemed to be, I don't know how to explain it, a real vital kind of alive and, I wouldn't say joyous, but really like a feel-good kind of state. And, I don't know if that, like, describes it. It's been many years. That was quite a while ago. Huh. But it was a pretty intense Yeah, it was great. You know, like, well, who wouldn't love? I mean, I don't know. That's my kind of idea of time, right? I just like, oh wow, great, lights off for like, you know, for 10 days. And you know, the other component of the was a really rigorous mood test. And so, you know, there was three different types of mood tests and stuff. And so, you know, which would like turn up, you know, sigmas, and it's like, well, I don't know if that's exactly how, you know. So it's a very, very robust, and really kind of probing kind of like experience. And I actually was doing the course with someone who was training to be a instructor or be able to do that. And I think that there's a sort of a day four meltdown. I mean, he really melted down. He was just like,
"Oh no, what happened?
It's normal, apparently."
What happened?
Oh well, he was just became really, really angry with the doctor, and started accusing him. It's just off the hook. I mean, I think I don't know. Like, it was just like a real kind of And then I think that what happened is that you know, his alpha, well, you know, like a lot of what increases alpha brainwaves for different people is really different. Like, so we would be in these kind of intimate sort of sessions, how we're describing what were we doing, thinking, or how are we, you know, at this stage, what were you doing? Because this is when you were getting, this is when your alpha waves were like making significant progress. And, you know, like, for, you know, for him, like, it would be like, you know, imagining sexual activity or something like that. And that was good for a couple of days, but then it didn't do it, right? So it was kind of like, so it was like everyone. And then there was a few little tips that he would give us, but he was really like, were more techniques to apply to obstacles, say, perhaps it might come up. But but you know, mine was just like a steady. I was just like the slow. I was like the tortoise, you know, and he was like the rabbit, right?
Well, you were used to it, you know. It's interesting. I haven't done things like that, but for instance, even going to, you know, a 10-day meditation course or just sensory deprivation tanks, I always underestimate how much occult people are prepared for that. Whereas in contrast to how civilians are completely like unable to process even being alone by themselves for an hour.
Oh, yeah. I know. I'm kind of like, I've always been a bit of a, like, I really do like that, you know, like alone time.
Right. Well, what was happening, you know, with you? Were you tripping? Were you hallucinating? What was going on? Yeah.
I had a couple of like total out of body experiences. I mean, you know, it's like sitting, what's really interesting about it is that I felt like I learned more about, my mind, and I practice various forms of, you know, pranayama, meditation, and, you know, a lot of different things. But what was really, really one of my first experiences when you're listening to a representation of the way your mind sort of works, or the electrical activity and the, you know, how it's working, it was like this vision of this, like a kind of an astral kind of luminous kind of translucent jellyfish that would just, with the most sensitive little thing, would just wobble and go out of control and have these piercing sort of spikes with things. And you're just going, who is driving this engine? You know what I mean? Like people, like, I just was like, I thought I could kind of calm my mind down. You know what I mean? But actually listening to it, it was like the most super sensitive sort of, and that was really great, because it was, you know, it's the artifice, like it's in sense, it's kind of like giving you, sort of like a representation of it. And you know, and because of the dark, you know, like a lot of that time, you know, you'll have a visionary, you know, you'll see sort of like a, you know, this was particularly the best possible like representation of what was going on. And I was just like, fuck, man, I thought I was driving, but Jesus, what the fuck? You know, it was just like, it was really, really wild. And it was kind of humbling. And it was really good, because it was like, there's no nonsense. There's no like just sort of tricking yourself into thinking that this is happening, right? Because it's like, it's a real, I think sometimes people, and I'm not to take away from the genuine experience of like long-term meditative practices at all. I think you're right. I think that it does have a kind of like an effect, and it's an accumulative. And I think that people that do engage with, you know, some, those types of practices are more prone to be able to get the most out of those experiences. And I remember when I was in a friend of mine from San Francisco, and he took me for my first float, and then they were sort of saying, oh, you know, it's usually like, you know, we maybe an hour or something. They got me out 3.5 hours later, and I was just like, oh, great. They just went, oh yeah, we just left you, man. And it was just like, and it was great, you know. Oh,
that's awesome. They let you do that. Usually they cut you off after an hour.
Yeah, well, that was because my friend and he had done hundreds of hours in float tanks, you know, like in a different generation of things. He was also, I think he did a lot of those floats, like, I think, you know, John Lilly was one of his early inspirations. So, I mean, you know, he really spent a lot of time, you know, I remember seeing Altered States and just going like, what the hell? But anyway, he was like the real McCoy, right?
Yeah,
but,
I never turned into a prehistoric crab creature in a float tank. I'm still waiting for it to happen.
Yeah.
Very disappointed about this.
Yes, the reverse, the zoomorphic kind of, peeling back the, yeah.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for that. I guess I haven't done enough time. But that is crazy, though, because the thing about meditation is, what's the gauge of success? It's like the kind of demonic thing about it, in a way, is that it's totally subjective. The only, you know, only you can be a gauge of whether your mind is calm or not. And of course, this gives rise to so much delusion and self-trickery and the whole demon Mara and all this, but also the sense of, well, I mean, I'll just put it this way. I mean, the idea of using biofeedback and neurofeedback to get actual data on how calm your mind is fascinating to me. And I'm wondering if there are any, maybe if you know of any consumer versions of the experience that you had, or if there's some way to that people can replicate that type of experience with some device or something like that.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think that I don't know. I mean, Jim was really adamant that that basically using technology that induces alpha is like a modicum, and it's not training your mind. So he was really like, look, you've got to learn how to do this, not just switch off and turn it on. Okay. So I don't know. I'm not abreast with the latest technology with that, but he was a real advocate of like, you know, it's like, don't take the pill, like learn how to like you've got to put in the hard yards. So there may be some that do that now. I mean, you know, like I'm sure that, you know, that maybe technological advances in the last, you know, like 10 or so years but I haven't really kept abreast of that. But an interesting sort of story is like he did a lot of cartography. Like he did extensive sort of sessions with a troop of Zen monks, and so what he was trying to look at was sort of to, you know, map Satori, you know, and various different sort of like states, you know. And what he kind of noticed was that, you know, there was a, you know, there was a bunch of them. There was the head guy and there was another guy, and he noticed after he'd done the cartography studies, and he speculates that is what halos are. Like, so when you see sort of these depictions of halos, and sometimes they're at the back, sometimes they're at the side, sometimes they're at the top, his speculation is it's because there is obviously anomalous activity in that that part or lobe of the brain. That's just sort of like a side sort of speculation that he, you know, was talking about. But what was interesting was is that out of all of the monks, there was one monk who had a very similar anomalous kind of brain cartography that mirrored the teacher. And apparently, like, the monk was a bit of a rat bag, right? And he was.
What do you mean, rat bag?
Well, he just didn't do things like, you know, he was like the naughty kid or something. You know, he was like the one. I mean, he was always like the one everyone was like, you know, he's not doing the right thing or whatever. And then what happened was he was the one who got given the mantle. And Jim was like the mantle when the other monk said, right, I'm passing it on, I'm out. And he said it was really interesting. So that they exhibited the same brain cartography that was anomalous, that wasn't exhibited in the rest of the monks, and that maybe through proximity, that the person that had, you know, like, well, I suppose the hypothesis, well, it's not a hypothesis, I suppose, is that the one that had the mirrored kind of brain activity was the natural choice. I mean, how that happens, maybe that happens with a teacher. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like in a sense of how do you monitor the subjective experience? I think, you know, perhaps, you know what I mean? Because it's like hard to get out of your own subjective experience or whatnot, to get that objectivity. Or maybe that's sort of like, I think that I sort of realized that, like, through my martial arts career and stuff, is that you can't learn it out of a book. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be with it. You need to, like, you know, there's a system is sort of, you know, like, designed to cover the essentials, but the most, it's like what the old Kabbalists say, you know, you catch the Kabbalah like you catch a cold, right? It's like a contagion. And that, I think that there's certain stuff that when you work with the masters, like my experience of working with a keeper of the style, is that there's an osmosis that happens that can only happen through proximity. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, and I had some experience of that with, you know, like a Tibetan Rinpoche as well. It's like, you know, maybe because these lights are on or something, and these other lights are dormant in the aspirant or whatever it is that, you know, like, you know, things get kind of switched on, and there's, you know, slowly there's sort of like a resonance that, you know, is, I don't know. It's just, I'm just speculating, I suppose, but it's interesting.
I think that's exactly it. There is an osmosis, and part of it is nonverbal communication. There's so much of how we communicate is not linguistic, but also if I use precise scientific language about it, it's the vibe. You got to pick up the vibe from the person and the actual energy, and it can be evolutionary energy. That evolves you in ways that you may not be aware of until years later. Just listening to what you're saying both now and also about the neuroscience stuff, it just makes me think how little we know and how much work we have to do to even just to understand consciousness, and certainly peak consciousness and getting into, you know, I truly am a believer that whatever language you want to put on it, that human consciousness as it's generally expressed is just so minimal compared to what human consciousness could be. And we've barely done any work. You know, we have the occult, we have some neuroscience, we have saints and, you know, Buddhist meditators and things like this, but we've just barely begun, I feel, to scratch the surface of understanding ourselves, of understanding the mind and what's possible with it.
Yeah, well, especially with the current paradigm.
Sure. You know what I mean? But I think that it's changing too. I mean, I think I definitely have watched it change in the last 10 years.
20 years. That's true. I think that there might have been different times in human evolution or, you know, humanity and stuff, where I think they were kind of probably a little bit more on spec.
Yes. Yes.
Perhaps, you know, like But yeah, no, it's good. I mean, I think science is like, seems to be, hitting against those walls and coming up with different. It has changed a lot. It's exciting, and I think that, I think it's, it's like an old hermetic axiom, really. You know thyself, so you know, explore the parameters of your being, and don't set limits on it.
Absolutely. Well, what are you working on now, and what can people expect in the future, and where can people find out more about you?
Okay. Well, at the moment, like we just released a bit of our back catalog, you know, from the NOCO 210 project, and that was available through Bandcamp. I think a lot of the times we where we sort of locate or perform is usually in, like, you know, in an exhibition context, an exhibition performative context. That sort of seems to fit us best. So we just sort of finished, we did a big festival down here in Tasmania, Dark Mofo, which was like 20 performances over 10 days, which was pretty intense and great. But we're looking towards, I think we're looking towards trying to go stateside again. Like, so maybe look at, I work with a guy in New York, Stephen Romano, as well. I do a lot of activity with him, and he has a particular interest in esoteric art. So at the moment, we're just sort of like, you know, recalibrating after that, looking at a few different projects and to, you know, situate it in an art context. So we have to see if they eventuate at the moment. But, what are we doing? Gosh, we're always doing something. I suppose artistically, people can check out barrywilliamhale.art the NOCO 210 project. They can check out NOCO210.com. I also sort of contribute semi-regularly to Lexicon Mag, which is sort of like a esoteric kind of online sort of thing. And I think that's probably it. I don't know. I wasn't prepared for that one.
Awesome. Okay. Well, all sounds great. And yeah, that was an awesome conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh, great. Thanks, Jason. Yeah, it was great. It was really
cool. We covered some good territory there.
Cool, man. Like, it's a pleasure, and all the best.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Hope you really, really enjoyed that conversation. Make sure to check out magic.me, magick.me, for the magic and art class and all of the other courses that we have available, from chaos magic to ceremonial magic to tarot to I Ching and on and on. Definitely make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast so that you can get all of the new episodes that are going to be coming fast and furious. You can do that at jasonlouv.com/podcast. And hey, if you dig this podcast and you want to make sure that it keeps going and that I keep booking awesome guests and improving the quality and turning this into one of the best podcasts on the internet, then please become a Patreon supporter. You can do that at the same website, jasonlouv.com/podcast. And you get a lot of cool perks for becoming a supporter. First and foremost, you get access to episodes of the show far in advance of everybody else. I upload interviews as soon as they're done, just for the Patreon supporters. And you also get access to our Discord and special status on the Discord, where we have this incredible growing community of people coming up with all kinds of fascinating collaborative projects and having fascinating conversations about magic, spirituality, technology, culture, and lots more. So to get access to all that, go to jasonlouv.com/podcast. All right. Lots of love. I honor you, and I'll see you next time.